Okay, Tzaraim Tovim, Erev Tov, and we should hear good news, as we said. And okay, part three, I guess the middle part of the shiur, the middle part of the series. I think we're going for 5 weeks. I think that's what we originally scheduled. On freeing hostages, pleasure to welcome back Rav Tabori, and we'll let you get right into it, because it's important and tough and all too relevant topic. Vakasha.
Hi, Erev Tov, everyone. I would like to continue our series, and as Rabbi Jay just explained, the series is trying to go in some kind of chronological order of events that took place the past few months, and we're trying to somehow connect historically, not theologically, between the events that occurred right before and October. We spoke 2 weeks before this. We spoke about certain questions that come up regarding relationship between democracy, between legal matters and Jewish law. And that was really some kind of reflection of what went on here in this country. We didn't talk at all on purpose. We didn't talk at all about the issue itself, because that's really, I think, very explosive stuff. But I did want to touch upon different questions and matters that have to do with the issues that were discussed. However, today we're going to move forward and really begin the next few lessons responding directly to the historical events which occurred on October 7th, and how perhaps certain questions that came up during these times, in very, very difficult times, And what does the Jewish law, what does halakha have to say about these questions? I really want to begin from the start. I am not giving any psaks chas v'shalom here. I'm not even viewing so much my personal opinion as much as I'm trying just to discuss together the issues to for people to be aware of certain matters that come up, that can be discussed. I know things, especially, I mean, you know, these things are explosive, really. There's a lot of emotion. People, I don't want anyone, chas v'shalom, to feel uncomfortable. And therefore, I'm going to be very, very careful of not to talk, obviously, politics, but really not to talk, and not to speak directly to the issue exactly, but rather to discuss the issue from a little bit of a larger, perhaps, distance. So today we want to talk about the matter of pidyon shvuim, rescuing captives, and what prices can or should be paid in Jewish law for rescuing captives. Now, unfortunately, this question was a question that existed in Jewish halakha, in Jewish communities. It was discussed for hundreds of years, because it was a very practical, very relevant question in all generations. Jews, unfortunately, and by the way, also Goyim, were many times kidnapped, held for ransom. It became a business. I know what kind of business it is, but it became a business. By the way, it's not just anti-Semitic business, but there are countries today, without going, I think in South America in the 20th century, some countries that this was a very popular way of raising money, unfortunately. And so holding people for ransom is not just a Jewish idea, but Chachamim also had to respond to this question. What does the halacha have to say about the price that we can or we should pay for bringing back hostages? If you look in your source sheet that I'm posting right now, you'll see, we'll begin with one of the most famous sources about Bichlal, the mitzvah of redeeming captives, Pidyon Shvuim. The Gemara explains that redeeming captives, and you can see it in front of you, source number one, redeeming captives is a great mitzvah. It's not just some kind of description of this mitzvah in emotional terms, but as certain actually halachic ramifications the and what how far do we go to perform this mitzvah? What do we sell? What do we get rid of in order to redeem prisoners? I'm not going to go through the whole Gemara here, but if you go, hopefully this source will be sent to all of you. It'll be on the website, but you will notice that the Gemara here goes through certain psukim and explains that the urgency to rescue captives has to do with the fact that unlike people who are poor and need tzedakah, unlike the sick who need medicine, the person who is held captive is in immediate danger because he is also like a poor man. He is also like a sick man. He has every type of trouble. It comes together into one person and his life is in danger. And therefore, redeeming him, the Gemara concludes, is one of the greatest mitzvot, if not one of the greatest, if not the greatest mitzvah that one can perform in the area of chesed, is to redeem the captives. And we see this in Gemarot, by the way. The Gemara talks about this in Bava Batra and other places of how far we can do by selling Sefer Torah, maybe. The Gemara really explains. The Gemara talks about receiving tzedakah from goyim because that's something that we usually do not do. Pidyon shvuim, redeeming captives, is surely a very important mitzvah. So that's well known, and not much more to discuss about that. However, what is also, I think, quite well known is the Mishnah discusses the price of redeeming captives. The Mishnah in Masechet Gittin teaches us that we do not ransom captives for more than they are worth due to Tikkun HaOlam. Tikkun HaOlam is a phrase that repeats itself in the Mishnayot Masechet Gittin. It's a rule that the Gemara uses to explain why the communities have to have some kind of decrees and some kind of what we call takanot, what kind of laws that are not necessarily religious laws per se, but rather they are laws that are created by the community in order for a community to be able to function. And we need to live in this world. We need to function in this world. We have other people in this world besides us. The Jewish people have the non-Jews in their community living around them. We have other matters that we have to take into account when we want to behave in a certain way. We must take into account other factors. And Tikkun Olam is a halachic phrase, halachic term that the Gemara uses to introduce certain decrees of how we have to live as a community. And amongst them, the Gemara teaches us that we do not pay more than they are worth. Now this is a by the way, the Gemara also mentions we do not help captives escape due to Kunola. We a person should not. It's an amazing Mishnah, especially thinking about the context of nowadays. And the Mishnah teaches us that there is a price that is given for captives, and it's a mitzvah to redeem the captive, but not at all cost. There is a price, and we do not go above the price. There are two major questions here that we have to discuss. What is the price? How does one value the price of a captive, the price of a human being? I have to admit that I don't know. The people discuss this, don't get me wrong. There are poskim about this. I am not sure if we'll be able to answer this question so easily, I have to admit. And secondly, the question is, why not? Why don't we pay the price, whatever the price might be? A person's life is in danger. Surely, pikuach nefesh. We said that we just said that a person who is in captivity, his life is in immediate danger. Pikuach nefesh, we know, is one of the most important principles of the Torah. So why don't we just say it goes above any price that people offer? I'm saying this because I assume people are hearing this in my voice, right? There are certain voices today, and I will get to it. Obviously, I'll get to our days. There are certain people that are using the same phrase, right? At all price. I've heard people say this on Israeli news, on Israeli radio, on the media. They're saying, whatever price is, we need to get our captives back. people used that exact phrase. So obviously, like I said, this is a very tense, very emotional, dramatic subject. Once we automatically remind ourselves of what's happening right around the corner here in Israel. So I want to be careful about this, and I hope that no one from our discussion, I will talk about Gaza and what happened today, but please don't necessarily cut and paste what I'm saying right now until I actually say it to the situation of now. So people today are using that phrase, but in the Gemara says, in the context of the Gemara says, not at all price, why not? That's my second question. So if you go back to the source sheet, you will see that the Gemara asks the second question. The Gemara asks, why not? Why don't we pay the full price? And the Gemara suggests two possibilities that are very different. One suggestion is that we are concerned, you can see in source number three, we are concerned that because of the burden of the community, we are concerned of the price, that of the money that will be taken from the community, will destroy community. I mean, well, you know, if a small community is told to held ransom by one member of the community, and they are told to empty all their bank accounts, everything goes to, and they'll be, you know, penniless, and this will really destroy community. Or, however, the Gemara suggests a different possibility, which is perhaps because the reason is we are concerned that this will encourage them to continue doing it even more. The Gemara discusses these possibilities. For example, the Gemara says, come here about an incident that will answer our question. Levi, the son of Darga, ransomed his daughter for 13,000 gold dinars of his own money. Right? This is an amazing amount of money. So you see that perhaps this proves that it's all about not being a burden on the community, because the Chachamim, as if allow this man to give such amounts of money, because it didn't fall on the community. But if you understand that the problem is because we don't want to encourage this to happen again, the Chachamim would have discouraged this man from redeeming his daughter. And the Gemara doesn't accept this answer, because the Gemara suggests, as you can see, perhaps Abaye says, who says that he acted with the consent of the sages? Maybe acted without the consent of the sages. So there's really no proof. But I'm just sharing this source because here's a great source which is trying to understand what exactly is the problem. What are we concerned? What are we worried about? And the truth is that this discussion has many, many ramifications. The Gemara, for example, suggests that a person is allowed to redeem themselves for any cost. If a person wants to, we will get to soldiers, please. Yes. We will get to, we're only in the beginning right now, right? The Chachamim say, the rabbis teach us that if a person wants to redeem himself, he can redeem himself, even if it's the millions, it's his money, he can do whatever he wants to. Perhaps that can prove one of the sides, or not. You can argue whether or not this would prove it. The Gemara discusses what price would a man have to pay for his wife to be redeemed. When we sign ketubot today, we write everything in Aramaic, perhaps. Because we don't want, we do it because that was the language spoken then. But the problem is that many people don't always understand the ketubah. But one of the tsna'ei ketubah, that's not in the ketubah actually, but the Rambam mentions the conditions of the ketubah is that a husband has to redeem his wife in the case where lo aleinu she's taken into captivity, and he must perhaps pay a price that is beyond what is normal and accepted. Here again, people argue whether or not this would be an indication for the discussion that we just had now. How far can we go? Is it, and what is the reason? It seems, by the way, that the Shulchan Aruch, the poskim, actually argue that even for your own wife, there is a cap. You cannot just pay any source. So it seems that the concern really is about encouraging the goyim in this case to continue kidnapping Jews and holding them for ransom. That seems to be the main concern. I just want to mention in this context that, as I said before, there is a discussion of how does one measure the price of what's normal, what's accepted. So some people talk about slaves, the price of slaves. You know, that's something that's very hard for us to imagine today. How would we, maybe then, you know, hundreds of years ago, they could speak like that. They could use the idea of a slave. But really, in our world, how can one even think of what the value, if we were really use this principle, how would we interpret it? How would we translate it into our world today? What is the value? What's the going rate of a captive? I mean, can you imagine such a thing? So it could very well be that the answer would be, if Chas v'Shalom, we have this kind of situation, we would have to look what's going on in the world. We would go to, I don't know, Colombia or Mexico, places where, if I'm not mistaken, Lo Aleinu, holding people for ransom is more popular. Maybe we do a survey and see what is the going rate. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but perhaps we would have to use more modern terms if we would really go by this. Until now, we discussed Esugya and Masechet Gittin, and the Rishonim discuss this question. They argue about it, but I want to make sure that everyone is aware that we are talking about a situation in which bandits, pirates, kidnap a Jew and hold them for ransom. We are going to see in a few minutes that perhaps when we talk about war, things are very different. Before we get to there, I want to move from this kind of case, this type of case, to war by discussing a very sensitive case which comes up in the Gemara, which is not so simple. The Gemara tells a story. I'm going to skip there's a story in source number 5. You can see it in front of you. The Gemara again tells us the following. The rabbis taught it once happened that Rabbi Yehoshua, the son of Hanania, was traveling to a great city in Rome. They said to him, "There is a baby in the prison who has beautiful eyes." A good-looking young guy. Rabbi Yehoshua went by the prison and said, he used certain words to try to understand who this is. This Manshei Shlomenu, who was in jail. He tried, you know, they say they're of Herzog, after the Holocaust, when he went looking for Jewish kids, he went into these monasteries and he yelled out Shema Yisrael. Oh, he made a bracha or whatever, to see if these kids are Jews. And in a similar way, Rabbi Yehoshua tried to figure out who this person is, and he realized that this person is a Ben Torah, is a firm Jew. And he goes, "I'm certain that he will teach that this guy, this captive, is a. I swear by the temple service that I will not move from here until I've redeemed him for whatever amount of money they demand." Wow. See that expression? That expression is going exactly against our Gemara. By the way, the Gemara says that this boy in captivity was Rabbi Shmuel, son of Elisha, the famous Kohen Gadol of Beit Sheni, who was mentioned in many different places. We're not going to go into that right now, but this story seems to be very problematic as it goes directly against the Gemara. He announced from the beginning that he's willing to negotiate and pay whatever price they have to pay. And right away, which is very expected, the Rishonim point out the contradiction between this story and the Gemara and Gittin. In source number 6, you can see the Tosfot in Gittin, who questions, what's going on here? The Gemara suggests two possibilities. One is because the baby possessed great wisdom. Wow, we'll see that in a second. The other answer is, during the destruction of the temple, we do not want to encourage them to capture what's not in force. So the second answer means that this really wasn't a concern, that this was a, there were no, there was no custom of kidnapping and ransoming kids at the point. Redeeming at any amount of money was not a concern that this would bring more, kids to be held ransom. Okay, it's a technical answer. It's an important one because it means, according to Tosfot, that in times when, we're not concerned or worried that people will be kidnapped and by redeeming our prisoners, there'll be a rise in kidnappings, then we're allowed to pay any amount of money. It's important psak. However, the first answer, I think in today's world is not such a simple answer. It's basically saying, well, you know, there's a depends who. Certain people are have more value. In this case, a tamid chacham, we don't stick to the rule with him. Really, for normal people, we have a cap, but for tamid chachamim, there's no limit. This opinion of Tosfot, is not a simple answer. I don't think it's a simple answer. I think that it comes from a place of understanding that there are certain people in the Jewish community that, even if we don't value them, when it comes to, you know, to blood, they're the same value. But sometimes, you know, there are people that that run the community, and subjectively there's some kind of hierarchy of who we save, as if because the community needs them. And it's not necessarily because he's a rabbi. It could be that leaders, etc. Leaders. I mean, we all know what would happen if Chas v'Shalom, a leader, a military general, would be taken captive. I mean, a leader taken captive. It's things would be different, right? We understand that. So the Gemara suggests that perhaps a rabbi doesn't fit the regular kind of model. I don't want to go into this too much, but the reason I'm mentioning this is because of the following story. There are two stories here that are important. One story, to balance what we just said now, is a very, very famous story of the Maharam of Rotenburg. Maharam of Rotenburg, or Meir ben Baruch, who was lived in the 12th century, one of the most important Rishonim of Ashkenaz of Germany, was put in prison. By the way, there are scholars today, academics today, suggest that the reason why he was put into captivity was because he, with his family and a bunch of others, tried to escape Germany and make his way to Eretz Israel. At the time, there was a decree that Jews were not allowed to leave. You know, we can't win. Either we're expelled or we can't leave. It's just whatever. But he broke the decree and sneaked out. He was caught by some Jew, of course, who told on him to the authorities, and he was put into jail. And he wrote Sfarim from jail. We have his commentaries in which he writes, from the prison, he writes, I'm in prison right now. He writes in his writing. The Jewish community, of course, wanted to pay the ransom and to free Maharam of Rotenburg. We have to understand, by the way, that even till today, the Maharam of Rotenburg is considered to be one of the most important posts in Jewish history. Many of his rules are the basis of the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch of Ashkenaz Psak. It really was very important. Now, using the source that we just mentioned, surely one could argue that the Jewish community should pay any price to free the Maharam. The famous legend and story, and I do want to go into, there are arguments about how the story happened, the details. If people are interested, I'm happy to talk about it another time. There's a it's fascinating to understand exactly how people describe the story from what the context was and what they say about it. But the famous kind of story that we all were brought up on was, and it's an important narrative, is that Maharam Rotenberg refused to be freed from prison, and he died in prison. He died in prison because he refused to be redeemed. And it's not hard to understand that he was concerned with what the Gemara suggests, is that this would encourage others or perhaps the burden of the community. And he did not rule, right, for himself, the psak of the Tosfot, that for rabbis there is no price. For himself, it was a big Kiddush Hashem, I think, the story that he refused to be redeemed, and he died in jail. I say that for two reasons. A, because it's important to know that, you know, Chas v'Shalom, rabbis did not in history use this kind of psak, and just because that would really be sound as it would feel a bit uncomfortable, I think, to all of us. So it's important, A, to know that, and B, it's important to know that the Maharam's psak is basically teaching us a very important principle, which is not at all cost. Someone just mentioned, yes, they paid money to get his body back. That is correct. That is correct. That they paid money to get his body back. But that's a really a different question, which I don't want to go into right now. What's important here is that the Maharam's psak basically means that not at all, not we don't redeem prisoners for automatically for any price. The second reason why I brought this story is for another story. During the, as you know, during the 70s, there unfortunately were many stories of hijackings of Israeli planes, not just Israeli planes, but also foreign planes. Everyone knows, of course, about the Entebbe operation, the Air France 139 plane that was hijacked, taken to Uganda, to Entebbe, and we all know how Israel freed the prisoners there in a heroic mission. What people sometimes forget today, I'm sure I'm talking to a bit of a crowd that probably remembers. Some of you might remember this from your childhood or from your memory from years ago, the 70s. There were the Sabina plane that was forced to land in Tel Aviv, also freed by a heroic attempt of the Israeli army. There were also two El Al planes that were taken captive, that were hijacked and forced to land in Jordan. I'm sure people remember that on that plane, on that plane was one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim of the 20th century from North America, Rav Huttner. Rav Yitzchak Huttner was on that plane, and the terrorists demanded, you know, to they demanded the exchange of terrorists, and at that point, when it was found out in America that Rav Huttner was on the plane. So according to what I read, the rabbis, certain rabbis got together and using the opinion that we just read in Tosfot, argued that the halacha is perhaps, again, Maharam of Rotenberg doesn't agree, perhaps, right? But the reading of Tosfot is that for rabbis we pay a high price. So they some rabbis were inquiring were trying to fight figure out maybe they should create they should reach out directly to the Jordan government and free pay the price to free Rav Huttner separately from everyone else. They turned to the one of the greatest poskim of the time in North America, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and they asked him of his opinion. Rav Herschel Schechter quotes quotes this story in source number 9. He says the following. As we mentioned, a great scholar is ransomed even for a sum that exceeds his worth. Thus, many rabbis were of the opinion that every effort should be made to secure Rav Hirtner's release. However, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky disagreed. His arguing was that the mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim applies only in peacetime. However, he explained that nowadays, since 1948, since the War of Independence, has really never ended. And the Arabs have this death, the idea of the Arabs is to try to destroy the state of Israel, to drive us into the sea, that has never been renounced. In his view, it was considered the times to be the situation of war. He declared this is not what the Gemara is talking about. This is a situation of war. And in wartime, there is no room to separate between Rav Hutner and other people. Perhaps there is no room to use the regular, normal rules that were made up in the Talmud, because the Talmud wasn't referring to war. The criteria for redeeming prisoners during war are different than what the Gemara is talking about. There are new factors that are involved. Now, by the way, I will just let you know, by the way, that besides our matter that we're talking about, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's my idea, by the way, is very important for a different discussion, which is, what is the halachic status of war today in Israel? Are we halachically considered to be in a war situation? Mechemet mitzvah. It has ramifications for who has to be drafted to the Israeli army, who has to fight. Do we say that even terrorist attacks? I'm sure you all heard that today. Unfortunately, the terrible terrorist attack here in Israel, 2 people were killed. These random terrorist attacks that occur, as if not in battle, not in war, are they also considered to be part of a war situation? Rabbi, right? Because people think about war, they think about Yom Kippur War, they think about the Six-Day War. But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky held that since 48, we have been in consistent war situation. And that halacha has huge ramifications, which I don't want to go, which I'm not going to talk about right now. But for our matter, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, a major posek in North America, did not agree to redeem Rav Hutner. He did not believe that one should use the classic halachic factors, rules that have existed in the Jewish community for hundreds of years, because they do not apply to a wartime. I think this is a very profound distinction that I would like to make in today's shiur. I am not suggesting what should be done. There are many, hopefully, smarter people than me out there that have to make these decisions. But what I am suggesting is that the classic Talmudic arguments are not necessarily so easily used in today's situation. And I'll continue explaining why I think that is true. Rav Goren, Chief Rabbi Goren, has a long article about this question, specifically if an Israeli soldier is held by terrorists, what is the price that we pay? And he brings all what we discussed before, and he actually uses the Talmudic rules and says, listen, he wasn't, he, this article was written before Gilad Shalit. It was written, if you remember, after the first Lebanon War, there was a case of a few guys that we got back for, I think it was like 1,200 terrorists for one Israeli soldier. I don't remember right now the exact numbers, but Rav Gorin said that's for sure against the Gemara. That's for sure because the Gemara says that we not at any price. And everyone would agree that 1,200 terrorists is more than a price that we can allow for one Israeli soldier. Even if you thought, right, whatever criteria you use, slaves or what's worth in the world today, it's meshuggah to say that that is something accepted. And B, he says, and this is a major issue, which is, it's not, this is gonna encourage terrorists to do it again and again and again and again, exactly what the Gemara is concerned. And C, we're going to add that these terrorists are going back to kill more and more Jews, right? So it is, even if you want to, the beginning point is to use the Talmud's ideas, it's very hard to use in today's situations to reflect on what the Talmud have to say about it. But the major reason why I think that it's very hard to use the Gemara in this scenario is what Rav Gorin says at the end. It's a fascinating article because he starts by he basically he starts by saying, what we're doing today, giving so many terrorists for one Israeli soldier, doesn't make sense. It's against halacha. It should not be done. It's against what the Gemara Gittin says. But then he says, but truthfully, he says, I'm not sure that really it is wrong to go ahead with the hostage exchange. Why? He says, because the Gemara was talking about when bandits, pirates, choose to hold a Jew ransom in captivity, it's their choice as if who they choose. They have their reasons for choosing who they want to choose. And that's how they decide who's going to be held captive. However, when an Israeli soldier is held captive, he is not just a random individual who is chosen by the bandits. He's our representative. He represents each and every one of us who send him to wear the Israeli uniform. And therefore, said Rav Gorin, we have a direct responsibility which does not exist in the Talmudic times, to go perhaps where well and beyond the regular price in order to redeem him. So it's fascinating because Rav Gorin on one hand says that if we would use the Gemara's criteria nowadays, we would argue that we are paying too much and we shouldn't go ahead with the exchange. However, he suggests for other reasons, maybe yes, because it's not just a random as if Jew, right? Not that the Jew is random, but it's not a random Jew chosen by the people. It is our representative. We send him there. We have to bring him back. I think that if what we're saying is true, and I highly believe it is, then I again want to argue that it's very difficult to use the Gemara in Gittin, the sugyot of the Rishonim, very hard to use them as our kind of blueprint, as our as our sources, whether or not today we should go forward with prisoner exchanges, because as I said, it's very, very different. Which leads me to the following idea, which I really want to share with everyone. This, I'm just warming up here. This was just introduction. Now we're getting to the real shiur now. It became a hobby of mine the past few years to discuss and learn halachic challenges that come up in the state of Israel. And one of the major problems that the great rabbi that dealt with these issues for the past 75 years, one of the major problems is that 2,000 years, these questions weren't discussed, weren't learned, weren't argued, weren't written about. And some of these great rabbis, like Rabbi Israeli, Rav Gorin, Rav Herzog, they had to sometimes make up some kind of new definitions, new ideas, because for 2,000 years, we lived in the Chutz La'aretz, we lived in communities, we didn't have a state, a government, an army. These questions didn't come up on that kind of level. But one of the things that many of them always started with was going back to the most basic source that we have, and that is the Tanakh. And the Tanakh, with its stories and messages, is a book that dealt with the last time that we Jews lived in a country with our own sovereignty, with our own government. And although the book of Tanakh is, as we know, is not a book of law per se, it's not a Shulchan Aruch necessarily, but learning the Tanakh stories, I think, may sometimes give us some direction of where we should be going. In other words, what I want to say is that there are two as if potential sources of how we can today, what we can use for nowadays to try and give us inspiration of what should we actually do today in the very difficult situation that we find ourselves. The classic one in the religious community has always, in this case, to go back to the Talmudic stories of the Gemara and Gittin and the story of Yeshua and the Rambam and Wittenberg, right? We have so much, I didn't even share with you, so many Rishonim and Achronim and Poskim that discuss these questions. However, the alternative is to go to the Tanakh and ask ourselves, What are the stories of the Tanakh teach us about this? And here is the difference. The stories of Tanakh are so much closer to the times that we're living in now than all the stories that are mentioned in Jewish history. In Jewish history, I'm not a historian, so I can't say for sure, but almost all the stories that we know of were really about communities, about individuals, were held ransom for money. It was not even such an, I know it sounds crazy, it wasn't always anti-Semitic per se. Goyim were held ransom. It was a business. But this idea of where we find ourselves today in the state of Israel, having this crazy, unbelievable, terrible, tragic situation where we have our brothers and sisters being held by terrorists. Is that really? Are we saying that the Mishneh Gittin, the Mishnayot, the Gemarot are really talking about those scenarios? I think that if we open the Tanakh, we will find that the stories of Tanakh are much more connected to what's happening today here in Israel. Let's start with the first story of a Jew being held captive. He wasn't necessarily a Jew. In Sefer Bereshit, Perek Yudalid, we read about how Lot, the nephew of Avram, is taken captive. I don't have much time left, but everyone knows the story that Avram. It says that in Bereshit Yudalid, Pasuk Yudalid, easy to remember, 14:14. It says, Vayishma Avram, ki nishba achiv, vayareg et chanichav, vayirdof adan, vayichalek alem laila, vayakem, vayardifem. Avram is on a rescue mission. He fights the enemies. He gathers his... He's on a mamash, an operation. This is mamash, the first mifsa in Tebi, the first operation in Tebi. Doesn't, you know, the first heroic mission of the Jewish people to save to save prisoners is not in 1976. It's in 1948. I'm sure you all remember that Avram was born in 1948 for creation of the world, so it was a little bit later, but it was somewhere there. In Sefer Bereshit, Avram gathers his troops and rescues Lot. No negotiations, no peace deals. He goes and fights the enemy. Let's continue. In Sefer Bereshit, in Parashat Vayishlach, I don't want to go into this too much. First of all, we don't have much time, but B, this can get really a little bit emotional and out of control. But I have to mention that the famous or infamous story of Sefer Bereshit, which seems to remind me, I think many of us, a little bit what's going on here in Israel. Yaakov and his sons are living in Israel, and his daughter Dinah is raped and taken captive. And then the negotiations begin. Notice, the negotiations begin as if this is like a business deal. They're holding onto Yaakov's daughter. She's being raped. Who knows if she's being raped that moment when they're negotiating? And they're talking as if a business deal, as if it's, you know, it's okay. You know, this is normal. What are you going to give us? We'll give you. While they're holding a gun to Yaakov's daughter? Well, we know the trick of Shimon Velevi, and we know that they killed all the people of Shechem, and Yaakov was very upset at them. There's a lot to discuss here, a lot to talk about here. And as I said before, I'm not here right now to say right or wrong, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. It's interesting, right, that Yaakov and Shimon Velevi have an argument. Who was right, who was wrong? The Mefarshim, the famous commentators, argue what was right, what was wrong. The Rambam, Maimonides, says that Shimon Velevi were correct in what they did. Why? Because the people of Shechem were all as if into this. They were part of it. In what sense? They didn't rape her. They didn't kill. They didn't. Why? They didn't hold her captive. But the Rambam explains, because by allowing this to happen as a society, by not making sure that the people that did this crime should be sentenced, be put in jail, when a society allows atrocities to happen and people stand by and allow it to happen, they are part of it. That's a very powerful Rambam, by the way, Maimonides. The Ramban disagrees for other reasons. I'm not going to go to all the discussion right now, but I will tell you that Rav Meidan, Rav Yaakov Meidan, I'm sure you all heard of, many years ago, wrote his commentary on this story. I'm going to share it with you right now because I think it's quite relevant for nowadays. Rav Yaakov Meidan, in source number 13, says the following: as part of their attempt to rescue their sister, they kill every adult male. What this appears to mean is that they kill all the available fighters in Shechem. Any male who could raise his sword against them is killed. Look what he says here. He says, Shimon Velevi planned a rescue operation. And he said, this is what happens in a rescue operation. Innocents are killed as collateral damage. In modern terms, the people of Shechem should be considered a non-combatant population that cooperates with and protects the enemy. These are people whom the army fighting the enemy does not want to kill, but is ready to kill in order to rescue its people from clear danger. I'm going to let your imagination run with that, but I think it's a very powerful story. If you ask me, right, what source do I prefer to use? And I don't have, like, again, there's a lot to discuss here, but am I going to the Gemara in Gittin, or do I go to Bereshit? I feel that the story of Bereshit and Shechem is much more meaningful and powerful to be discussed and learned in the context of what's happening today. Because the Tanakh
was the last time that we dealt with real questions of a country, of a medina, of an army. And with all due respect, the Mishnah in Gittin did not. Let's move forward. Bamidbar Kaf Aleph. In Sefer Bamidbar, we learn how Am Yisrael were attacked by whom? Perakaf Aleph. By Yishma Knani Melech Arad. By the way, I today drove by Arad today. Tell Arad for those who know where that is. So it says here that the king of Melech Arad, and by the way, Rashi points out that these are the Amalekis. That this, look at Rashi in Bamidbar Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Rashi comments that it was the people of Amalek. Vayilachem b'Yisrael, vayish mimeno shevi. They take captives. What is the result of these captives being taken? Vayidar Yisrael neder la'Hashem. The Jewish people make an oath. They swear to destroy these people until they don't bring back all the hostages. Vayishma Hashem bekol Yisrael, vayiten et haKnaani, vayachrem etem ve'et arehem, vayikra Shem amakom Chorma. Let's move forward to Sefer Shmuel Aleph. Sefer Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed. David HaMelech, Vahi Bevo David Vanashav Tziklag Bayom HaShlishi. And lo and behold, who is he fighting this time? Can you believe it? The Amaleki Pashtu El Negev. The same Amalekis who took captives in Sefer Bamidbar are now taking captives. Who are they taking? They take David HaMelech's wives. Vayaku Et Tziklag Vayisrefu Ota Ba'esh. They burn. They burn down the houses. And they take Nashim. Mikaton ve'adagdol behimitu. They don't kill anyone, but they take the women captive. David HaMelech comes back. Pasuk Gimel. Vayavo David ve'anashav ve'la'ir. V'inei srufa ba'esh. U'nishehem u'vnehem u'vnotehem nishbu. I mean, you read this. I don't know, the associations I think are clear. David HaMelech goes in the Negev, in the south of Israel, comes back and sees his homes burned, and the children and the women are taken captive. It's a very interesting expression. The Tanakh teaches us, they started crying, they started wailing. I mean, it's interesting. Why is that important to know, right? You can, every time there's a tragedy. Because it even says here, they don't have any more strength to cry. They cried so much, they stopped, they couldn't cry anymore. The tragedy was so great. I'll tell you, everyone, you read the psukim, I don't know, a shiver goes down my back when I read the psukim. Now listen to this. Vateitzer David me'od, ki amru ha'am lisoklo. What did the people want to do? They wanted to kill David. They were so upset at whom? At David. Because they felt he was responsible. It was his responsibility to protect the women and children. And he didn't do his duty, and they anger with at him. And of course, we all know that Vayishal David Ba'ashem Lemor Erdof Achre Agdud Hazeh Ha'asigeno Vayomer Lo Redof Ki Aseg Tasig VeHatzel Tasig. David HaMelech, like Avraham, like Levi and Shechem, Levi and Shimon, like Bnei Yisrael in Bamidbar Kaf Aleph. That you see there is a certain model that appears again and again in all these four stories. That they go to battle, they go to war to rescue the captives. Now, these models obviously are very different than the Talmud. The Talmud doesn't talk about battle. The Gemara doesn't talk about going to war. It doesn't talk about negotiating ransom and paying money. It talks about freeing the captives with strength, with courage, by in the physical sense. Now, again, I am not voicing my opinion what to do right now. Negotiations, not negotiations, what the price is. I leave that to the army and to the government, right or wrong. I'm sure everyone sitting here this year has their opinions and what they think. And I am no better than anyone else, to voice my opinions, because I think that what is interesting, and that's my only real observation tonight, is that when we, living in Israel today, in the state of Israel, when we find ourselves in these really terrible situations, I think that it's quite important to not necessarily run to the classic sources always, which we've always done in the rabbinical literature. In this case, I think we should be also inspired at the biblical stories. They have a lot to teach us. They are much more practical or relevant to our days rather than the stories that occurred even in the last century, when we didn't have a country, when we didn't have a state. All the halachic discussions then were about communities, were about individuals. They were not about acts of war. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, as I said before, made that clear distinction in 1970s when he explained that we cannot use the classic Gemara and Tosfot to separate Rav Huttner from everyone else, because in war, the rules are different. Things change. We cannot use the classic Talmudic models that existed in the past. That's really what I wanted to share with you. As I said, I don't know if we were smarter than we were before about what to do, but I hope at least I tried to show you that there are two models that could be used, and I want us maybe to think a little bit about looking at the Tanakh more as a not just like the good book that we read for about the past, but many times we could learn from it perhaps ideas for the now of where we are in right now. We have 3 more minutes left, and I'm happy to open the floor to questions, comments that people have. Bakasha.
And if the questions go over a minute or two, or that's okay, at least from our end. So don't hesitate to ask a question, because you think the answer might be 3 minutes and 12 seconds.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I just meant that.
No, of course. Thank you. I'm just, anybody has any questions? If not, I'll throw out a question.
I'd like to make just one comment. Yes. Gilad Shalit was ransomed, I forget how many years ago it was, there was a lot of flack about you're violating Rabbeinu Amram Rutenberg's established principle. I don't remember who it was, but at the time, somebody wrote a counterpoint that noted that there's a factor here, especially for soldiers, that a soldier in the army has to have the emotional support. He has to have that feeling that if anything happens,
right, so
they're going to go all out to rescue him. That's a factor that I think would have been mentioned and wasn't.
Right. So, Mark, I actually on purpose did not mention that factor. I'll tell you why. Because hopefully next week,
you will.
Hopefully that's you were a promo for next week. You were the because Bezat Hashem, we have 2 more shiurim, and one of them will be talking about moral support of Israeli soldiers as a halachic factor, and that's where I'm going to connect today's shiur to that issue. So I thank you, but I am planning to pick up on that point.
It's hard to say everything at once, I know.
Thank you. Yeah.
Isn't there something different about today, though, than the Tanakh, in the sense that you have part of the Jews living outside of Israel and you have part living in? And I'm sitting here in Illinois. What we do here affects people in Israel, and what people in Israel do affects us too. And to a lot of these anti-Semites, you're a Jew. Whether you practice, whether you don't practice, no matter where you live, time to get rid of you. So is that a consideration that would have to be taken into account too in this? That it would be slightly different than the examples you gave us in Tanakh when everybody lived in the land?
I tried very carefully to explain that it's very hard to cut and paste from the Tanakh to our days in the sense that this can be used as a real, you know, this means that this is what we should be doing. There's no way that we can cut and paste a Tanakh story and just say, oh, it teaches us now for sure what the ruling should be. I'm saying that it's a source of inspiration. It's a source of realizing that war is different than Jewish communities being held. That's all I tried to say, meaning where does that take you? You know, again, our leaders and politicians and army have to make that decision. But the distinction, what I tried to make clear, is the distinction between the Talmudic stories and the Tanakh stories. And there are obviously many differences between even the Tanakh in our days. I agree with you. How does that translate exactly to our days? That's a much more difficult question. And I agree with you that it's not exactly the same.
I mean, if I may, just, you know, we're talking about, the, you know, how complicated it is, of course, and applying in new things, unfortunately. But I remember when the Gilad Shalit was released, so Jonathan Sachs was in Toronto. He actually came for the 10th anniversary of Torah Motion, but he was in Toronto, and he said that, you know, it may be halal. I can picture him saying it. I remember he said it may be halakhically questionable, it may be politically unwise, it may be blah, blah, all these things that's wrong, but he's very proud to be part of a community that would do so much to rescue one soldier. And it was just the way he phrased it, was such, you know, in his beautiful style, just very, very powerful. Like, yeah, you can give 1,000 reasons why it's bad and maybe even dangerous in the future, which we see. But, you know, at the time, something you do what you now we could save a Jewish life. And that's what they did. So I don't know, just throwing that out for whatever it's worth.
Wasn't one of the people ransomed, released for Gilad Shalit, the mastermind of what happened 6 months ago?
Sinwar was one of those released.
That is correct.
Sinwar was one of those released. Yeah. Many of the ones released are involved in this. No, I that's what we're saying. Like, right. But it's always hard to know. I'm not, if you're not issuing, you know, I'm for sure not saying any Pesach Halakha. It's very difficult. So right. Sometimes we do it now. We can't worry what's going to be in 10 years. That's, I know. And there'd be somebody else.
By the way, that specific question, by the way, came up in the Entebbe operation. Rav Avadi Yosef, at the time chief rabbi of Israel, was asked by the government, or suggested himself, to advise Yitzhak Rabin at the time. And he wrote a whole tshuva during the days that they were held hostage. And he came to the conclusion that they should go ahead with the negotiations of exchange, because he said that the prisoners, the hostages, were in immediate danger, while the Jew that might be killed from the terrorist released is in a what we call safek situation. So these questions, you can argue with them, but they were discussed by certain rabbis during these very sensitive emotional ordeals.
Rabbi?
Yes.
A tertiary question related to this. Given that there are hostages, and I'm talking about what the Palestinians consider hostages, like the Sinwar, who was a hostage, does this mean that we should rethink the death penalty for certain people, not to keep them languishing in prison so that somebody will be taken hostage to free them, but when you have clear-cut cases, to just murder them, kill them, so that they don't become, you don't get into this bargaining situation?
Interesting you say that, because Rav Gorin, I saw that in his article, he actually does say that, by the way. In his article, he mentioned that. I think, though, that this is a question more for the army. You know, that many times these prisoners are very, very valuable to retrieve information. And that also saves lives. So
after you debrief them, you have a proper execution.
Maybe, I don't know. That is a possibility. I don't know. That could be. That's something to be discussed. I hear.
I think the security forces have always recommended against the death penalty. That's my understanding. The Israeli defense establishment, the army, thinks in the end it will be worse for Jews and for Israel if we actually have a death penalty for terrorists. I'm not commenting. Like Rav Soloveitchik often said, these are questions, like you said, to be decided by people who know much more than we do,
right?
People in the army, and their feeling is, you know, can take the emotion out of it, that Jewish lives are better served by not having a death penalty for Palestinian terrorists. I think that's their.
Could I just? I don't want to get into the politics of it, but there should be, I think, political discussion by the people, whoever is in charge of the policies, the foreign policies. And we shouldn't do it. I would hope it would not be as an act of revenge, but as an act, as they did in Nuremberg, that these are people who gave up the right to be considered as any typical other person to be exchanged. I would think that there should be a national debate on this. It should be brought out and not just say this army says this and this general says that and this. I think it's worthy of discussion.
Yeah, look, I this is already a little bit out of my expertise. Rabbi Kelman, you can take that.
Yeah, no, I hear, right. Yeah, listen, as you say, you want to address the broad topics. Getting the specifics is very hard. And we don't know what can we say, but okay. I'm sorry. All right, tonight at 8:30, Becky Friedman, who is the operations manager at Associated Hebrew Schools here in Toronto, has taught here, won the Chidon HaTanach for Canada a number of years ago. She'll be giving the Parsha Shir tonight at 8:30. Tomorrow, of course, my Shir on the Siddur at 9:15. And I want to wish everybody well. Good news next week of Rabbi Liebtag and Sunday morning, et cetera, as always. And we should hear good news, and everybody should be well. And please invite a friend to join a class. Okay. Be
thank
well,
you
everybody.
You
have to worry. Be well. Yashar Koach. Thank you. Thank you. Sarat Tovot. Okay. Be well.
Good evening.